studios in Eugene, Oregon, it's Oregon Update with your hosts, Cliff and Robin. You can join Cliff and Robin by dialing 646-721-9887 or by email at talk@krbnradio.com. And now, here's your hosts, Cliff and Robin.
Actually, I guess we got to change that before too long because we got Brad with us too. So this morning we've got Cliff and Cindy and Brad and not Robin. How's that for?
Good morning.
Change. Robin is on assignment somewhere, working very hard. Yes, I heard you. And so, hello. Did you guys go away?
Good morning.
Somebody went away. Cindy, are you there?
I'm here.
I keep hearing the Skype sound of somebody coming and going. I don't know what's going on. So anyway, there are supposed to be three of us talking this morning, and Robin, if possible, she may get in on the telephone if she can where she can hear us and can do that. She may be busy and can't, so you never can tell. So we'll find out. But it's going to be an interesting day. We've got several things to talk about. What are you doing here? Sounds like you're throwing glasses. Are you having a big party? A happy 50s party or something?
We're having a party and didn't tell you about it.
Yeah, really. I had.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there you are.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right.
I wondered what happened. So.
Technical difficulties on Wheel Dryer Hill.
It's a morning of technical difficulties because this is only like the third time I've ever run the switchboard, and getting here took me right up until the last
minute. It was an adventure, a white knuckled adventure.
Really, isn't that the truth?
Oh.
Well, today we're going to talk a little bit about some taxes. That's, of course, what's on everybody's mind is the taxes situation, and the fact that our delightful country is in trouble financially. Some people think we may be coming upon trouble. I think it's a little wrong. It's just like I put on the webpage, I think America is broke right now. Right now we are broke. As a matter of fact, since they tell us in 2014 we're going to owe $7.25 trillion, I think that's long past broke myself. I don't know. Everybody's got their own ideas what to do about it and why and how, but who knows if anybody has an actual answer. Going to talk about taxing the rich, and of course, everybody has an opinion on taxing the rich. I'm sure that mine is not going to be the same as everyone else's.
Probably not.
Let's look a little bit at this this whole tax bill, the Ryan thing, more than anything, because that pitched against Obama's idea of what to do are the two main points coming on
uh-huh.
the road as to who and how we're going to get out of this whole thing. The Paul Ryan, is that his name, Paul Ryan? Anyway, he has emerged as the...
You mean Rand Paul?
No, Ryan.
No. Oh, Paul Ryan, okay.
Actually, the Pauls, Rand Paul and Ron Paul, are the two that I've been rooting for a long time. What?
That's why I thought you were talking about, who I thought you were talking about, for that reason.
No. Ron Paul is the one I like, but he's so radical that I don't know that – I think I'm probably, along with everybody else, I don't know if it's possible at this point to elect him, to actually get him elected. He has moderated his opinions and his views radically since when I first started watching what he was doing, but – he does have the right idea. In my opinion, this whole thing has to go back to the basic root of changing the tax code, radically. Everybody talks about the fair tax, which is a sales tax. I don't think that's it. I think it needs to be just a flat tax. You were talking about that, Cindy. We do talk before we go on the air.
Yes, we do.
Huh?
I said, yes, we do.
But the flat tax is the only way I think that it can be done. And I don't know that the United States population is ready. Well, if they... I just don't know if they understand what flat tax would mean. What do you think, Cindy?
Well, we have discussed, you know, the 8 years I was on the county budget, county commission when we were dealing with budget deficits year after year. And I know on several different occasions we put together like a blue ribbon panel of really smart people to look at ways of raising new revenues for the county. And one of those was always, let's create a county tax. And we wanted to be a flat tax of 2%. So the people that everybody's paying the same 2%. And those folks that opposed the flat tax said that it was regressive because it put an undue burden on those that were at the low end of the income and was, you know, 2% of, you know, $1 million was something that people could afford, whereas at the other end, 2% would be cutting into using every penny for survival, and that would be unfair.
Well,
so that's what I know about a flat tax.
Didn't you ever consider putting a low cutoff point? I mean, anybody under $12,000, $15,000, $20,000 didn't have to pay it?
Well, that might have been one of the suggestions when we had our public hearings on these ideas and ask for public testimony.
Yeah.
that you would have a floor that you wouldn't tax below a certain income level. But, you know, this is what I did learn in my 12 years as elected official, is everybody loves taxes that other people pay.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, that's why I think...
if you find a tax that everybody else can pay, that would be your ideal way to raise revenue to fund government services.
I think that's why the flat tax is actually probably the best tax, because everybody they're paying equally, ready or not, because the person that's making $1 million a year, 2% of $1 million is a whole lot more than 2% of $1,000 or $10,000 or $50,000. So they're paying a lot more. This business that just because I make more money means I should pay more money. And speaking of lots more money, I mean, they've got this tax the rich thing. I don't really agree with that. I mean, I don't make enough money to worry about it, but on the same token, I don't believe that they should be, I think, unfairly penalized just because they make money. I mean, if you're talking about right now, where our tax rate is up around, and this is not the whole tax rate, but it's up around 25-27%, I think, and they're talking about they could bring it down to 19%. Or less, probably considerably less, if they did the whole thing as just a flat tax, because everybody would be paying the same thing. And the thing that gets to me, okay, I'm just going to come out and tell my opinion of the taxes. Everybody wants to tax the rich, and they're talking about, what is it, $600 billion or something like that, if they went ahead and repealed that tax cut for the supposed tax cut for the rich.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to get that. They might get that 1 year. And then the people who have all the money, they're going to hire more people, and they're going to find ways around whatever it is we do. So unless we make it a tax code that is so simple that it can't be evaded, we're not going to get that extra money. Not going to happen. They're going to just hire more people and change their tactics So if we just say, okay, everybody pays 10% except anybody under $30,000 or whatever, you can't...
Whatever the poverty rate is that's used to calculate to provide social services, I mean, that seems like the place where you want to start from there up.
Well, that's where I have a problem, because then we're talking again about the federal government deciding who those people are. See, and that's what I don't have any faith in, is the federal government deciding much of anything at this particular point, to be honest with you. I think the whole population is at this point getting rather upset about what the federal government, any ideas that the federal government has, because most of them are lining their own pockets. And so, and that's the other thing, again, that I believe that everybody, absolutely everybody, the president, the senators, everybody should have to go by all the rules.
Not, I couldn't agree more.
There's just no possible. I mean, this is not, we don't have a king or a dictator. Well, we have one who thinks he might like to be one, I think, but that's another story.
Well, hey, I agree with you that our current tax system is just a monster.
Well, it really,
and,
Winnie, do you know
and how, it is always confusing. The people that can afford to hire a tax preparer, you know, they find tax loopholes that the ordinary people that are just filling out your simple form to get their refund back are not going to they could probably get more back if they could afford to go to a tax preparer.
Well, you know, I don't know if that's the case. I've gone to a tax preparer before, and I never found them doing much for me, to be honest with you.
Ah.
I found it just as easy, and maybe because I have never been one to make big bucks. I was noticing, what was it? I was watching a television show the other day, where they go and buy houses.
Uh-huh.
This lady bought a house, and her monthly payment was only $2,700. Well, I've never made much more than $2,700 in a year, in a month, rather. I mean, I've made about $3,400 is the highest I've ever taken home in a month. And that's, you know, I couldn't pay $2,700 on a house payment if I was making that kind of money. It wouldn't work. But that's, people are just not making that kind of money. I mean, it's just amazing how, well, I guess people are making that kind of money now at this particular point. I guess because that's been a while ago since I was making any real money.
Well, in my research for today's show, I found an article that talks about Steve Forbes, who's part of that Forbes Publishing Empire.
Uh-huh.
And he also sits on the board of the National Taxpayers Union. And he ran for president on the Republican side in 96 and in 2000. And he campaigned on a platform of medical savings accounts, a new social security system, school choice, term limits, strong national defense, and a flat tax. And this flat tax is a subject of a book he wrote that came out in 05 called The Flat Tax Revolution. And I kind of remember the media hype around this when it was first published. But that's what I was referring to earlier. He says, he describes the federal income tax code. There's 4 points: a monster of a system, abominably, appallingly confusing, a multi-headed hydra of countless brackets, deductions, and exemptions, and our horrifically heavy, appallingly complex, corruption-inducing tax code. That's a mouthful.
I like him. Because, you know, that's really true. Because I wonder, do you have any idea how many pages our tax code is? I mean, I know it's horrendous, and most of them are written in good old legalese, so you can't understand.
Oh, of course. Yes, you've got to have an army of attorneys to decipher it.
Well, and that's it. And they're the only ones that can afford that army of attorneys. I mean, even if we went to a tax preparer, I've been to a couple of different tax preparers, and they aren't really that prepared. They just hire people who have an idea of what the tax code is, and you, by using it and preparing more, they learn a little bit, but they don't know what's going on. The tax people who work for the IRS don't know what the tax code is and what it's all about. I think probably the only people who come closest to totally understanding the tax code would be the people that GE hires, or that one, you know, Dickens, or somebody who hires these people to go in there and figure out how to keep them from paying taxes. And that's, they pay big bucks to these lawyers and other people and whoever. I don't know who they hire. But they pay big bucks to these people to sit down full time and read over this stuff and find ways to get around it. So if totally reading over this stuff meant reading four lines, you'd be real hard-pressed to find ways to get around it. And so that's my opinion of what we should do, is to change that tax code. But then again, then right now we pay, God, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of people to the IRS, because mm-hmm. they have the ability. You can call them, and it's, I believe, free to call the IRS and discuss your tax bill and how to do what and how to not to do it. But even mm-hmm. they're not sitting there trying to find ways for you to get around it. They're trying to find ways for you to pay it.
Right, exactly. They're not in your favor. Forbes says here, compliance costs in terms of time invested to do your returns have skyrocketed from an average of 17 hours, 7 minutes 15 years ago to 28 hours, 30 minutes. This was as of 2005. And that's lost productivity is in the billions of hours, and the cost in dollars is now around $200 billion. I mean, that is, it's so time-consuming.
And it isn't getting better.
It isn't getting better.
Right. But one of the things about this Paul Ryan budget is he cuts the income tax rate by nearly a third, from 35% to 25%. That's one of the first things he does. I don't know how exactly. I haven't got the actual bill in front of me. I've got information about what it's all about. Basically, his budget is supposed to reduce spending by $6.2 trillion over the next decade and reduce the deficit by $4.4 trillion over the next decade. And everybody talks about the next decade. What about us, our poor people who are trying to live now? I mean, we're looking at $4 a gallon for gas, and probably before the end of the year, $5 a gallon. Can you imagine that?
Oh, God forbid.
Can you imagine that? Right. As it is, I don't dare go anywhere. Because
that penalizes people that live in rural areas like we do, where you have to go drive 25 miles in one direction for some basic services, for health care and for purchasing, major things that aren't available in your small community.
That's right. That's exactly right. And
if you take the bus, it's hard to bring home a stove on a bus.
Yeah.
Or a new computer system or whatever.
Even groceries. When we go grocery shopping, we go to Eugene because there is a store there that's cheaper, bigger. But I'm wondering if we actually save any money because of the cost to get there and back.
The gas prices is really going up. That's true.
Yeah, it really is. It's just
I now know who Paul Ryan is. He's a Republican in Congress who chairs the House Budget Committee.
Right.
Forgive me for not knowing that right off the top.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just assumed that everybody knew who Paul Ryan is because he's...
Well, for those of us like me that didn't, now we know. We are in the know.
Yeah, he's been in the news for quite some time now because he is the only logical, legitimate, whatever word I want to use for it, alternative to President Obama's budget. And he's the one that the Republicans are basing their whole system on at this particular time. He put this thing together, and it caught on really, really quickly. And then I kept watching. I didn't get to see the speech or the talk where Obama did this, but Obama did a publicized on the air talk last week, and invited Paul Ryan to be there, uh-huh. and then stood there and chastised him from the front row. I mean, if my opinion of Obama wasn't bad before, it went way down at that point. I'm beginning to think that Obama is doing this on purpose. He may not be stupid. He may be... I've heard all of these rumors about his un-Americanism, and I'm beginning to think that maybe some of these are not that far off the base, because he seems to, well, we find out now that when he gave in, supposedly, at the end of the year to the different changes in the tax code, he did so reticently. He didn't want to, and now he wants to go back and change that. He wants to go in and repeal that. Well, see, first of all, it wasn't a tax cut for the rich. It just wasn't a tax hike for the rich. And now he wants to go back and put in the hike that they were talking about originally. He says that the only reason he went along with that was because he didn't want everybody's tax rate to go up. I don't believe in that either, because originally he was quite willing to let everybody's tax rate go up until everybody yelled at him. But his motives, I think, are becoming muddled. Would that be a word?
Well, you know, President Obama and his administration has grown the size of government. Since he's been in office,
35%.
Yeah, and so I think that, and with that, there's a price tag that goes with that.
Absolutely.
And I think that he is recognizing. I think the Tea Party is calling for a smaller federal government and pushing more power back to the states for decision-making and how to invest in government services. You know, I think that he's becoming aware with last November's election that this is an important issue for the American people. But, you know, he also talks about, President Obama talks about having to make shared sacrifices in order to continue a lot of the entitlement programs that people are surviving on right now, such as Social Security and veterans benefits, school loans, education, especially higher education, community colleges and universities and technical trade schools. They are counter-cyclical to the environment. In good times, their enrollment goes down when the economy is booming. And then when the economy tanks, everybody runs back to school to learn new skills. And it is just a constant feast or famine for the education folks to know, you know, you got to reinvest. I know here in Oregon at the state level in our legislature this session, Governor Kitzhaber has proposed putting all of education under one umbrella so that funding could be thoughtfully and strategically delivered to be able to be a little more nimble on its feet than having to deal with a higher ed board and a community college chancellor and the state board of education that governs K-12. So I thought in the readings that came out around the introduction of that bill back in January, it seems like there's some common sense for me. And I'm in favor of, at least in Oregon, of abolishing the education superintendent, because the governor appoints all the people to all those boards. So why not have the governor be that person and save that six-figure income and reinvest it along that continuum where it can have a greater bang for the buck?
You know, you're awfully quiet, Bradley. Have you got any thoughts?
Well, I'm about ready to fire something off here.
Yeah.
You know that really nothing's going to change in my viewpoint in this country until we address the issue of, and I know this is a whole other subject one day, is illegal immigration. Because every time we bring somebody into the United States as a citizen, I mean, that's about $1 million of income taxes to the Federal Reserve and the owners and all their counterparts, what I call the American corporation. And they don't want to stop that because it's just another excuse for them to keep their taxes
talking,
going.
You're talking about coming in legally, aren't you?
Either or.
Well, coming in illegally, we don't see any money. I mean, I'm a little confused. this is $1 million that you're talking about. That's how much money we spend, or is that how much money we get?
That's how much money you're going to get when you turn them into a legal, legal counterpart.
So I see, because I don't mind if they come in and become legal citizens. I don't see a problem with that. We do have limits as to how many we can have and all that sort of thing. It's the illegal ones that are costing us huge amounts of money, and it's most of that huge amount of money is somewhat hidden because it's not costing the federal government that much money. It's costing state budgets and city budgets that kind of money because they're the ones with all of the health care and the unemployment and all that they're drawing from and not paying into. And so that's where we're in the process of bankrupting, I would think, a whole bunch of states and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because there's just – and we haven't – you know, that's the thing. The Paul – there's the only thing I have to criticize the Paul budget is he doesn't take much money from the defense fund. And believe it or not – at least the president's budget does address the defense fund somewhat, not nearly enough, because I think that defense budget is way, 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 way out of proportion of what it needs to be. But the thing is, we need to take a considerable amount of that defense budget and turn it into defending our country at home, on our borders, and not in Afghanistan and in Libya and all over the place. I'm sure we're gonna get ourselves involved in a long term thing in this Middle East business because we can't get into any of these things without staying. Look at the Vietnam started as just a helping hand, so to speak, and look what we did there. And at least when Bush went after Iraq, he didn't disguise it to be a helping hand. He just went in to clean it up and did it. And from what I saw at that time, we did a very good job of going in and taking over the country. But then we made the mistake of thinking they were going to consider us heroes. I mean, we just went over and destroyed their country, and they're going to consider us heroes? Hello? Didn't happen.
Well, one of the arguments for America staying in the international game here for defending freedom, personal freedoms, is that if we just pull back our defenses and we go back into this isolationist policy that we had prior to World War II, for example, we didn't jump right into that European war. We waited. After Hitler had started rolling over all of the countries in Western Europe, that before we said, that's enough, we can't stand anymore, and we jumped in. But now that we're in the 21st century, where we have all kinds of new ways for being vulnerable than what we had back then, for us to be in the game and sort of being in place around the world, I think that that's keeping a lot of international terrorism from coming to our front door. That by us being with freedom fighters in other places, that's helping keep our family safe here, safer here at home.
But
plus it's trying to bring American freedoms, which many people believe are a premium. That are not Americans. We often take our freedoms for granted because that's our birthright, and that's just the way we see the world. But for other countries where you can't do things that we take for granted here, like gathering together and talking about politics, if you have a dictator that views you as subversive, I mean, you could go be thrown into a hole that they call a prison. I mean, it's like going... Ours is like going to the Ritz when you go to jail here in the United States. You get 3 squares a day and cable TV and a couple hours in the exercise yard, and you can earn your education degree. And, I mean, our penal system here is just, you know, a Cadillac compared to what other countries have.
I'll agree with that. I'll definitely agree with that. But I do think we go overboard about how much money we spend. I mean, look, even right now in Libya, we're supposedly not doing anything. We're letting NATO and whomever, North American, what's the other one? Anyway, we're letting them do it, and the other countries that are stepping in and doing things. But if you look at it, we're still financing almost all of it. We're still the ones with all the airplanes and all the different weapons of mass destruction or whatever you want to call them. But we still, even though we're standing aside supposedly, we're doing the bulk of it, I think. And
well, as one of the wealthiest nations in the world, this kind of goes back to the taxes thing.
But we're
I don't find that surprising. And countries like Japan that are an economic powerhouse because of what happened in World War II, you know, we essentially are covering them for their military needs.
Well, of course, right now Japan's got their own problems, and so.
Well, of course, but I mean that just came to my mind of another reason why we're spending a whole chunk of our military budget to have Americans stationed in Japan.
Yeah, yeah.
For that reason.
Yeah. Well, I do believe we can have whatever you want to call them, minimal bases in all these different countries, but I think we really definitely go overboard. I mean, our defense budget, when you look at all of it, the defense budget itself is only 566 or 85 or something like billion dollars. But if you look at the actual amount of money that's spent, because the defense budget doesn't include the salaries of the soldiers, it doesn't include buying a lot of the parts, it doesn't include a lot of the stuff that is still defense. So if you sit down and you look at it, as of 2008, it was actually $980 billion, almost $1 trillion. So as of today, it's way over $1 trillion. And that's you know, that should be a major portion of our budget. Unfortunately, because of the fact that our federal government has, like you pointed out, grown by about 35% in the last 2 years, that's not a major part of our budget anymore. And so we need to bring it back to the point to where it is, in my opinion. And I think we could cut, because if you go back and look at how much money was every time we did a budget was allotted to defense, it's 6.8% increase. Almost every year it's been 6.8 or somewhere right around that vicinity. We could probably, I'm quite sure, in the last 2 years, gotten along without that 6.8% increase. Just leave the budget alone for defense and let it sit where it was and let them learn to live with what they have. But we didn't do that. Every year, including this year, there's a 6.8% increase. So we could, by just getting rid of 2 years of that 12%, 12% of $1 trillion is a lot of money and could go a long ways towards balancing. I don't know.
Okay, well, let's talk about some American communities that are supported by those defense dollars for creating the hardware and the software that keeps that military machine operational. If you start cutting the federal deficit by reducing the cost of our military needs, then that's actually going to have an impact at the local level on checkbooks of people that are involved in that. What do the protesters call it? The military industrial complex.
So that's why, again, that's why I wasn't talking about cutting it. I was talking about not increasing it. Just leave it where it was. Don't give them that 6.8% increase. They don't need
that. The cost of material goes up.
Well,
so it's, you know, there are some inflationary factors to consider here of holding something steady year after year after year. You no longer can produce as many widgets as necessary, you know, flak jackets for that help protect lives of our men and women overseas in armed conflict areas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying.
And I did know, I do know from the sheriff's office when I was on the county commission, is that flak jackets, you don't just buy one. That after a while, their effectiveness starts to deteriorate. So after a while, you have to replace those flak jackets.
Oh.
So that, and I didn't know that, but that is that's true. And I also wanted to make a another personal note. My husband served in the Army during the Vietnam era. He went into radio communications, and he was trained to be one of those guys that wears the pack with the big antenna that's on the front lines. He was attached to the 7th Division Artillery. And fortunately, when his number came up, it would be communication class 1234 to Vietnam, and 5 goes to Germany, and 1234 go to Vietnam, and the next one goes to Korea. Well, he went to Korea, and he ended up being one that was maintaining that demilitarized zone between North and South Korea from 69 to 71. And fast forward to the mid-1990s, and my church youth group kids, some of them after high school graduation, went into the Army, and I had one of them that was following the same career path that Ralph did a generation before, to Fort Lewis and then to Fort Gordon, and was literally training on the very same communications equipment that Ralph had 20 years earlier.
That's so
you know, there are, I mean, this whole military spending thing, that's just one little illustration. I can see where they were putting more monies into, you know, the bazillion-dollar airplanes that dropped, you know, a half a bazillion-dollar bomb when necessary. I remember when we were engaged in that airstrike Libya last month or month and a half ago.
$1,000 per...
Yeah, they quickly got out their calculators and said, this is costing us this much money.
And so that's partly my point, is that that we are spending too much money overseas. That I believe, you know, we're talking about 6.8%. We're not talking about a huge amount of money. Well, we are talking about a huge amount of money, but not percentage-wise. And inflation is not 6.8%. It's only about 3.4 or something, half that. But so we could cut half of that. But I just believe that could be made up in various places. For that matter, I believe, technically speaking, if we got really serious about it, it could be made up in cost overruns and things like that, because, you know, we don't need these $400 toilet seats and that kind of thing. And I don't think we've gotten rid of any of those. I think there's still a lot of that going on. So I think we could probably save that 6.8% without depriving any of the people making flak jackets and things like that. I mean, just looking at every country, you know, Egypt, we give them $1.5 billion, and all these people that we're giving all this money, cut each one of those in half or something. And I do believe we could save huge amounts of money and not really deprive people a great deal. I haven't sat down. Maybe I should. And you're right; it could be another whole program. We could sit down and figure out what could be cut and where. But the thing got to me is Paul Ryan didn't even address that. He just left. People have this tendency to do what you're talking about and leave the Defense Department alone, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing by leaps and bounds. And I don't think it's necessary. We don't need to let it grow that much. I don't really think we need to let it grow at all for at least a few years. We can go back to that if necessary, if we feel that we're depriving them for some reason or other. I would rather deprive that at this particular time than take a big bite out of Social Security. I mean, Social Security is basically, well, it's affecting me, for one thing. Because, you know, everybody says, well, Social Security system was set up at the time when 65 was, that was about all the longer people lived to 65 years old, and that was eligible.
That's a good point.
Except that that isn't true. If you go back and look where did it go? What was the date? in the 60s sometime or whatever they set this, the life expectancy was 74.6 years. It wasn't 65, and it's only 78.3 years now. I agree we could probably raise the eligibility rate to 72. I think they've already done that or are talking about it. And that's okay because I'm already getting there, so it won't affect me at all. But the idea of making huge big cuts in our Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, the Medicare and Medicaid is a little bit hazy because of the fact that the Obama budget has this big medical program that we haven't gotten rid of yet. It's still there. We're talking about getting rid of it. So that's an awful murky place to be, is in that medicine thing. And
yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen.
Before we go on to that, I just wanted to say the Christian Science Monitor has posted a story on the five ways, the difference between Paul Ryan's Republican proposed budget for 2011 and President Obama's. Number one is taxes. Number two is the size of government. Number three is the federal safety net. Number four is Medicaid. And number five is Medicare. And so those are the five differences. And you're right. It doesn't mention anywhere of our military spending. But I'm looking at a report that U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates warned of a looming crisis should Congress not pass a fiscal year 2011 Pentagon spending measure. And this was a press conference he had back in February. And he said that he offered to shrink the Department of Defense spending request by $8 billion in attempt to advance the measure, which has been stalled on Capitol Hill. And that the Department of Defense has been operating under a continuing resolution for nearly 5 months. That measure limits Pentagon spending at $526 billion. And the department requested $549 billion for this coming year.
Right.
So there's an increase.
Else is talking about capping it. In other words, not raising it.
And that the Defense Department could get by with a $540 billion. That's the $8 billion. And this was his quote. This was Gates' quote. I raise this point today because I'm concerned that the debate over the defense budget in recent days and weeks is becoming increasingly distant from strategic and operational reality. Distance, in other words, from the real world. He said, in fact, suggestions to cut defense by this or that large number have largely become exercises in simple math, divorced from serious considerations of capabilities, risks, and the level of resources needed to protect this country's security and our vital interests around the world.
See, that's my contention is that we're not protecting our country. Not really. We're over there doing something. We're imposing our opinion and our will on other countries and making them, because, you know, the Muslim countries don't think the way we do, and yet we're convinced that they should. And I don't think we should be changing or trying to change their way of thinking. That's their privilege. And so we, you know, unless we're literally protecting our own selves for some way, or protecting them, and they've asked for it in some way, we should get the hell out of there. I mean, we're spending way too much money, and we could take a huge amount of that money. I mean, there's a city just across the border in our own Mexico, our Mexican border, that 11 people a month get killed, murdered.
Oh, that's so true.
11 people a month get murdered.
But, you know, we have increased allocations to our U.S.-Mexican border.
Not enough, obviously.
Well, you know, there have been some of the major networks have done some, like a investigative reporting magazine show where one of the reporters rides along with the border security folks. And, you know, you'll see some high-profile stories that will trigger some reporters to go down there and to get the full story.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, if you take a look, and if we're watching the news, just recently, a matter of 3 or 4 months ago or something like that, our president met with the Mexican president, and the Mexican president says, you can send people into our country, but they can't carry weapons. They can't protect themselves.
Mm.
And that we agreed to that. I mean, that's stupid, in my opinion. We shouldn't be sending people in there without being able to take care of themselves. We send them in there only to get murdered by their Mexican cartel. And the Mexican government is powerless to do anything about it because the cartel runs the government at this particular point. So why are we negotiating with someone that's being run by drug dealers? And we've got to do something about that border. I mean, we built this big, well, it's not really a fence, but border thing, and then didn't finish it and turned it off.
And where it is finished, they're just tunneling underneath it.
Well, they don't even have to do that now. I mean, this was most of it was done through the air with radar and stuff like that, and they just turned it off. Just spent how many millions and millions and millions of dollars, and just I think we spent $1 billion on it, something like that, and they just turned it off. We're just not doing it anymore. And who made the decision to do this? And you know, people wonder why the United States, the confidence level in our senators and representatives is so low, and it hasn't gotten much better, by the way. And so we just sit back and let them bumble their way through. I mean, our Congress is not making logical decisions somewhere along the line.
That's nothing new.
Well, yeah, and that's the problem. You have that opinion. Most people have that opinion. And that's sad. Why do they have that opinion? We have the ability to have some of the finest minds and people in that position. They're being paid well. Why are they that inept? And that's back to my...
I think because they're getting paid too much. That might be part of the problem.
Well, I think another big problem is the lobbyists. You know, in order to run a federal election for yourself, you have to have just a boatload of money to do that, and you are dependent upon those lobbyists to help you get those, you know, television ads and to do all of the things that are necessary to be reelected. And so I think that's a big part of it, is that they end up voting for their friends who supported them, and they're not making good policy decisions because most of our congressional representatives are not independent anymore. They have special interests they must cater to keep their job, which gets back to the term limits and campaign spending. You know, America's in the 21st century. It's time for us to come up with a better way of getting elected. I mean, now we've got all this electronic connections. The folks that are of my grandmother and my mother's generation are still in the last century for a large portion of them. They're not tech savvy, but for the young people coming up, they certainly are. And in the next 25 to 30 years, you know, there's going to be ways to be able to get your word out without having to buy a bazillion dollars worth of TV advertising.
So we should limit all campaigning to Twitter.
No, I'm just, well, I'm saying in the future, a huge part of it will be a Twitter, Facebook, social networking. That seems to be the direction that we're moving.
Yeah.
For this younger generation. I mean, they talk about, you know, the 1 minute soundbite on television is now whatever the word limit is on Twitter to get your word out.
Obama did have a town hall meeting on Facebook last night. I forgot about it and didn't listen, didn't go to check it out. But it'd be interesting to know if you got anybody on there or not. But he's actually doing more for the social media thing than anybody else so far. I don't know how well he's doing. And I don't think he raised, $750 million when he ran for office. via the internet. He's trying for $1 billion this time. I don't think he'll make it, but it has nothing to do with the internet. It has to do with his lack of popularity at this particular point, because an awful lot of people are really disappointed with what he has done, I being one of them, because I did vote for him. I really did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, unfortunately, which is really too bad, because I have spent the last year trying to figure out if what he's doing is on purpose or if he's really that stupid. And I think I've come to the point that he's really that stupid, unfortunately. Between being that stupid and he's not a leader, he lets somebody else tell him what to do and what to think. And
well, they said the same thing about George Bush, George W. Bush, being a puppet to Dick Cheney. So, I mean, every president who sits in that chair in recent times has been accused of that very same thing, of listening to all the wrong people for all the wrong reasons. That's my observation.
I think
President Obama is a very bright man. I think George W. Bush was a very bright man. So, but sadly, they get portrayed as stupid by folks that have your opinions, Cliff, because they seem to not be thinking for themselves in your mind.
Well, he keeps changing what he's doing, and that doesn't make any sense to what he changes to. He changes his mind and then votes for one thing and then comes back and says he really didn't change his mind at all. He's going to vote for against it now. And as far as Bush listening to Cheney, I mean, Bush chose Cheney. I mean, he chose someone that he felt that he could listen to, that he could believe in, and he could trust, just as did Obama with O'Biden. With O'Biden, yeah, right.
There's a Freudian slip.
First of all, I think Biden is very bright himself. Unfortunately, he made a couple of comments and didn't pay attention to what he was saying, and hoof and mouth disease in a couple of instances, and that's what he's been labeled with for some time now. But I think he's got great ideas, but I don't think Obama is listening to him as much as he should. I don't think Barack Obama chose people for the right reasons. He's not doing his presidency for the people. He's doing it for politics. He's doing it to still be a politician and stay there. I mean, I don't think he has the American public in mind most of the time with anything he does, except to say, like when he voted for the tax thing, he had the American public in mind because he knows if he didn't vote for it, they wouldn't vote for him. And so it wasn't really the taxpayer he had in mind, it was himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying. And I think that's what his whole presidency is about. The reason he was so enamored with it was when he went overseas and got this rock star results at every place he went. All these people yelling and screaming and filling big venues with people and all that kind of stuff, and he became a star. And that's why I think he's still there, or got there, is he was really enamored with that star status, not with actually trying to work for the American public. And I don't think he...
Well, let me play devil's advocate here to that picture that you've just painted of our president. And I will be the first to say I did not vote for President Obama in that election. However, my faith and the Bible tells me that I have to respect whomever God puts into those positions of government authority. So, with that said, I think, and having been a public policy maker, albeit on a very, very much smaller scale, when you go and you talk to large groups of people that have differing viewpoints, your goal is to try and listen to what everyone has to say and to try and find some sort of middle ground, if you can, so that people feel like they have been heard and maybe they didn't get everything that they asked for, but there's something in what you do that they can say, you know, I believed in that, and look, that elected official is doing that because I asked him or her to. And as an elected official, you know, at the county commission level, we sit as judges on all kinds of land use matters in this quasi-judicial type of environment that has very strict rules about how you can receive information and who you talk to. In Congress, you know, there are a couple of sidebars that they've put on political contributions and gifts that you can receive from different groups and lobbyists and things like that. But you still have that opportunity to listen to all kinds of people, and you can receive information. And so if I'm an elected official and I've taken a position on something and new information surfaces and I consider that, and that carries enough weight that I might want to change my original position, I don't think that's a sign of weakness. I think that's a sign of wisdom, so that you are not locking yourself into a particular ideology and you're accepting information from all sources, because you know that the decisions that you make and the political actions that you take, whether to pass or veto an important piece of legislation, all of that is critical to having a government that we can all say that government is looking out for me.
Interestingly enough, most of what you've just said I agree with. And I agree that coming up with another opinion, listening to other people and having a different opinion. However, I think there's a frequency limitation. I mean, he's constantly changing his mind. And maybe I have to agree with you. Just because you've made a decision doesn't mean that if somebody comes up with a better idea or a different decision and you agree with them, that you shouldn't change your mind. But you need to try to put in your own opinion in there somewhere and come up with your own idea somewhere. And I don't think he's doing that enough to make it his own administration. And he doesn't listen to any specific people, I don't think. I don't know what he's doing. And I'm just, at this particular point, he vacillates so far, so often, that I find it real hard to trust what he's putting out there. It's really difficult. You know, I've been sitting here. I'm not doing a good job. 646-721-9887. I forgot about that. If you want to get in on this conversation, and we'd love to have you in on the conversation, somebody's got to have a different opinion from what I have and what Cindy and Brad have. Sooner or later, we've got to come up with Brad and find out if he has an opinion. But basically, give us a call. 646-721-9887 is the telephone number to call. I'm not going to tell you go into the chat room, because somewhere along the line, I opened the chat room, but I don't know where it went. And so I don't know if there's anybody in it or not. So sorry if you're in it.
There's a couple people that are there, but they haven't made any comments. So,
well, if they do, you let me know, because
okay,
because I lost it. I came up and it was on a page and then it went away. So I don't know where it is, if it's anywhere, but the telephone number, we can always get to you. I do know how to put that on the air. I have a little button here I can push. So 646-721-9887 is the telephone number to call. 646-721-9887. And we're basically, I don't know, we've pretty well covered, I think, the Ryan bill. I don't know if we really have or not. I just...
Let me, if I may jump in, Cliff.
Yeah.
Just a couple points here on the comparison between President Obama and Representative Ryan's bill.
Yeah.
Just under the, you know, I mentioned there was five different differences,
right,
that the Christian Science Monitor. On taxes, Republicans call for holding the line on taxes, while Obama said budgetary problems demand shared sacrifices, including higher tax revenue. Both sides agree on the need to simplify the tax code and keep those tax rates low, and to broaden the base of revenue by reducing the number of credits and deductions. I just want to comment there that I've been on unemployment essentially for the last 2 years this July, except for one job I had for 2 months. And because of that, And my husband hasn't had an increase in his salary now for several years. So we didn't have to pay any federal taxes. In fact, we got a tax refund at the federal level, but we got killed by Oregon taxes.
Oh,
we
yes.
ended up having to pay the state. And so I do think that we need to simplify the tax code. And I think that right now for folks, as we are right now, we got a lot of credits that were available to us that weren't at the state level because we didn't do any energy credits or anything like that. We didn't buy a hybrid car. There were some tax credits at the state level that we simply didn't have the means at this point in our lives to be able to go after.
Uh-huh.
So it says, while not claiming that taxes on the rich can close the government's fiscal gap, Obama attacked the Ryan plan for cutting already low taxes on the wealthy. So that's kind of the differences between the two.
Well,
Republicans want reforms to be revenue neutral in simplifying the tax code. Democrats say that more revenue is needed when mandatory spending is going to rise due to the baby boomers' retirement.
You know, the thing that gets to me, where do you start? Where do you start? Tax reform, we need to change the tax code, and that's imminent. I mean, it's just an absolute necessity. Where do we start? Do we start with that? Do we start with different things that are – how do you know where to start? Because everything is almost impossible to do.
Yeah.
Changing that tax code is going to be – it needs to be – because it needs to be changed so drastically. How did we get in this position? Well, I know how we got in this position. That's again, every time you want to do something, you make another bill. You make another law. You change and add more to it. You don't ever change it. You just add more to it and modify what's there. So, you know, we end up thousands and thousands of pages of everything. Everything, absolutely everything.
Campaign
finance reform. That's a real important thing because it's to the point that you can't run your office. You can't be in office. You've got to spend your entire time while you're in office figuring out how to get back in office and to run for office again because it's so expensive. So how can we expect our senators and our representatives to literally do anything? We can only expect them to work a couple weeks a year because the rest of the time, they're out fundraising.
Well, and President Obama's last job before his current one, when he was a senator from Illinois, he was no sooner elected to that job than he started running for president.
Right.
Did
he ever really do that job? He always voted present. He never really voted for anything.
So, and I know that was a criticism.
And I know that was a criticism.
Hello.
Hello.
Things happen with this thing every once in a while. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to, that would be a good opportunity to segue into point two that the Christian Science Monitor says that the Ryan and Obama plans differ. Both would sharply cut federal spending relative to what they call baseline forecasts.
Yeah.
But the Republican cuts go much deeper in what would amount to an assault on the current size of government. The Obama plan calls for cuts in discretionary non-security spending that would match the cuts proposed by the president's own bipartisan fiscal commission. The Ryan plan would trim discretionary non-security spending by $923 billion over a similar period. But the Republican plan...
$3 billion is such a small amount with $7.5 trillion or whatever our budget is going to be. I mean...
And that's what it says here. Republican plan targets a range of mandatory programs that are other than Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and they're asking for $1.8 trillion in reduced spending between now and the year 2022.
Which is in 2022? My God.
Yes, $1.8 trillion between now and 2022.
Well, even I don't even believe that's fast enough.
The Ryan plan envisions other federal spending excluding Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest on the debt, it envisions that that is going to fall, the federal spending, 12% of the gross domestic product last year to 6% by the year 2022. The Congressional Budget Office says the Ryan plan, by holding such spending to the rate of inflation, means that federal spending would not keep pace with population growth or average income.
I don't know. If you're holding it to the rate of inflation, why wouldn't it? I mean, what else is there that makes things go up? I mean, that's inflation is.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Well,
that confuses me.
That's what the Congressional Budget Office says.
Yeah.
Because this is why. The category of spending has exceeded 8% of the gross domestic product every year since World War II. So we have been spending that much more of what we create. And that if we cut it back to just the rate of inflation, then we wouldn't be able to keep pace with our population growth or average income.
The population growth was part of inflation. I mean, average income is not. I can understand that, because that the average income can go up independently from anything, and shouldn't. Because the average income is what's killing our country right at the moment. That's why everybody gets upset when wages and jobs and things go to other countries, but there's no chance they're going to stay here when it costs twice as much to manufacture something or to do something here than it does in Indonesia or something. So they're going to go to Indonesia to do it. I mean, that makes sense, only just too much sense.
Uh-huh.
Why would we do something here that costs us 10 times as much as it does somewhere else? So
That's right. We're
going to send it somewhere else. So we've got to do something. And that's what I'm afraid of. That's what this whole thing boils down to. I'm afraid of there is going to be a huge collapse in our economy. And it is going to happen, because that's the only way that the wages and the prices and everything is going to go down at once. And we've got to come into line with the rest of the world somewhere along the line, or we're not going to keep up, and we're not keeping up. And so I think this whole...
Well, we are borrowing so heavily, and that's a whole other topic here, is what we're facing in America here with raising our ceiling.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, that's why I don't believe that we can do that. We've got
to
do something about that. And I believe that raising a debt ceiling is just one more rung in the ladder of destruction at this particular point of our country, because we can't do that. We're just going to keep raising that debt ceiling, and we're going to price ourselves out of the economy of the world. And this is just an American economy anymore. This is a worldwide economy. This is everybody's involved. And I haven't thought to spend a whole lot of time looking into what France and England and Germany and all the rest of those guys are doing, because I know they're way ahead of Pakistan and China and some of these other countries that don't have the money that we do. But I don't think they're so far ahead as we are. We're way out in front of everybody and stumbling.
Mm-hmm.
Going to be stumbling faster than they are at this particular point until we do something about it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately,
I agree with that.
Unfortunately, if we don't sit down and consider something like Paul Ryan or whomever and stop spending the money, that's the only way we can do something about it, is not spend the money. And if we don't do that, this is going to happen awful soon, I think, that we're going to be in big trouble. So regardless of whose program it is, the answer has to be not spending the money. And if we're not spending the money, that means we're going to have to either not do something,
uh-huh,
turn it over to the states, individual, to let them do it. And I know that's hard to do too, because they don't have any money either.
Well, and they're dependent on the feds to give it back. And there are some states Oregon, for many, many years, has been what we call a donor state to the federal government, where we pay more in taxes than we get back in services compared to other states.
Well,
but this is a good segue, Cliff, to point number three here between the two budgets, Obama's and Ryan's, the federal safety net.
Yeah.
And, you know, prior to the Great Depression and the New Deal of FDR that was updated in the Johnson administration with the Great Society legislation, that Americans have become more dependent upon government services and not as much individually responsible for charting their own future.
Mm-hmm.
And this plan here, the House Republican view in Ryan's Path to Prosperity budget, focus on smaller government and individual responsibility. And the argument that the resulting prosperity will help Americans in general be better off. And did you know, I didn't know this until just this moment, that what we know as food stamps that helps low-income citizens and children and seniors be able to not go hungry?
Yeah.
Well, the House budget document calls for restructuring the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, acronym SNAP,
yeah.
that was formerly known as food stamps. The cost for this program in the last decade, it says, has exploded. From less than $18 billion in 2001, it's now over $80 billion today.
Ooh.
And the recession is one big reason. But Republicans say it's also that states lack incentives to make sure that able-bodied adults on food stamps are working, looking for work, or enrolled in job training. Let me just finish this one point. On the other side, President Obama and his plan argued for a very different view. He lauded Americans' self-reliance and said that the America I know is generous and compassionate, and argued that, quote, we would not be a great country without government programs designed to help ensure the well-being of seniors, children, and low-income citizens.
See, that's where I think we've gotten off track. I think way back, before my time even. Hello.
Hello. I think you're old as dirt, so that's a long, long time ago.
Long time. I think our system was set up so that the churches were supposed to take part of this responsibility.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They're not doing that at this particular moment. Some of them are doing a lot of work for it, but some of them are not. And
when they do, there's so many government strings and limitations attached to it. Many churches just say, I'll pass.
We've got to get rid of the government. We've got to make the government smaller. And the only way to do that is to have them not spend money. If we don't want Oregon to be sending more money than we get back, then we've got to stop sending money, and then we've got to have an end to the government, federal government control. For example, how much of the state of Oregon is owned by the federal government?
A huge hunk.
And it's ridiculous. They're not doing anything with it.
Nope.
And
the payment in lieu of taxes, since we can't develop that land and raise local taxes.
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So, and it puts us in one of those catch-22 situations.
And it's a thing with Washington and Oregon both. There's nothing you can do about it, because how do you fight federal law? And so we need to have a point where there's a lot of federal laws that have to change, and change radically and drastically. Now, there's still got to be some consideration as to how to, in other words, if the state starts managing all this land that the federal government now owns, there's got to be some controls to make sure that it's well taken care of. I mean, you know, you don't want to go out and just chop down every tree there is and not do anything about it. But all of this stuff, we have the ability now and the technology to manage forests and things like that so that they don't just disappear and go away.
Mm-hmm.
But the federal government is not doing it. It's just all sitting there. And as a matter of fact, half the time it's burning up. And if we managed it properly, I don't think we'd have anywhere near the forest fires and things that we have now, which just destroys things rather than utilizing them. We could make money in a couple of ways off of these forests that burn up. And we need to consider all of these. There's so many different options that we need to consider, all of them boil down to a smaller federal government.
That's right.
And so that's what we...
Well, the county commissioner who is representing our area here, the Eastland Commissioner Faye Stewart, is a member of the Stewart family that founded Bohemia Lumber Company, which went out of business here about a decade or a little more than a decade ago. But they still have an active interest in how forests are managed.
Uh-huh.
And with the disaster in Japan and with their immediate need for lumber to rebuild, he was proposing that for the federal forest in Oregon that have already gone through all of the vetting for environmental and the lower courts have said, yes, this is legal, you can go do, and the environmentalists keep appealing it and keep appealing it. What a great way to put Northwest folks back to work to do a good thing to help our neighbors across the ocean by being able to harvest some timber that is scheduled to be cut. And if all of the environmental issues have been resolved to the point where it's ready to go, and now it's just stuck in an appellate court process that moves at a glacial pace, this is, why can't Congress step in and say, okay, we're just going to act here and we're going to harvest this much and we're going to ship it over there and we're going to help them and we're going to help unemployment for the first time. I mean, it's still 12%, the newest unemployment, 12% in Douglas County, which is Lane and Douglas County were two of the biggest timber producing counties for generations in Oregon.
Unfortunately, Congress runs at almost the same glacial pace that you were talking about. So who knows what they would do, because they spend a lot of time deciding to and do anything. I mean, it's unbelievable.
But I thought Faye's idea was a good one. In fact, he says, I proposed it in 2005 in the wake of Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
As a way of helping people rebuild in New Orleans as well as and the Gulf Coast states, as well as creating jobs here in the timber country.
See, we should be able to defer to someone who knows what they're doing. For example, I don't know about his company. I assume that maybe they know how to harvest all of this and still not destroy the forest. But if they don't, Weyerhaeuser does, because Weyerhaeuser has renewable forests all over the country, and they do a very good job of it. So we could turn it over to them, and they would be able to do it. But why can't we just give up a little tiny bit of control somewhere along the line and let someone who has the experience do the job? And so at least something gets done instead of just sitting there.
Well, we have, the ancient forest of the Pacific Northwest, a lot of them have been harvested already. And on publicly owned lands, we now have second growth timber that is in production that could be utilized for this purpose without touching any ancient forest.
Absolutely.
That everyone, there have been huge swaths of uncut timber that have been set aside that we're going to leave these as they are. And I think that that's a good thing. But for all the second growth that's out there that's on public land, I don't see a reason why that can't be considered a renewable resource and be able to create jobs and put food on people's tables, get them off unemployment so that they're not dependent on the government for their basic survival.
I have a question. These ancient forests, why do we need so much of them? I mean, what does that accomplish, an ancient forest? Just because it's old means we have to leave it alone?
Well, the way God made it, it does serve a very important person. It does have a global impact because it creates oxygen, and there are certain things that a mature forest will do that a young forest will not, in terms of a balanced ecosystem. And in terms of filtering the rainwater down into the aquifers, I mean, from the years that I served on the watershed councils here in Oregon, I had a great education in forest ecosystems. and watershed health. And so I do believe that at one point that was, and that could be a contributing factor to why the Earth is warming up so fast, is because we've taken some of the pieces of this creator-designed ecosystem that should be balanced is now so unbalanced.
Of course, you see, I happen to be a firm believer that it's not us that's creating global warming, that it's this 1,500-year cycle, and there's not a thing we can do about it. Sorry, because we're just going to have to learn how to live with it. And that's what we're...
Well, that may be, but even if we had that 1,500-year cycle, you know, there are folks that are saying that we're speeding up that cycle on the downside of it by cutting a lot of trees that provide oxygen and cooling and pollutant filtering functions that used to be there that aren't there now. So I think we're both right on that.
I'll stop. I'm not going to freak out to stop.
Well, it's now 11:20, and we've got 10 minutes left in our program today.
Is there anything else we wanted to cover? I mean, we've kind of just stayed right on this subject somehow or another.
Well,
all over the subject.
I have point four and five of the two plans. Number four is Medicaid. The Republican plan converts the federal share of Medicaid spending into a block grant that gives states the flexibility to tailor their Medicaid programs to the specific needs of their residents. And by doing this, Republicans believe they can save $735 billion by 2022. And the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, in its analysis of the GOP, says that federal payments for Medicaid under the proposal would be substantially smaller than current projected amounts, but the flexibility for states translates into new efficiencies, and the cuts in federal funding would require states to reduce payments to providers, curtail eligibility for Medicaid, and provide less extensive coverage for beneficiaries. Well, the flip side, the White House says that President Obama's plan will make Medicaid more flexible, efficient, and accountable without resorting to block granting the program or reducing coverage for seniors in nursing homes. He aims for Medicaid savings of at least $100 billion over 10 years. So I don't know if you have any comments on the Medicaid program.
Well, I just... You're talking about $100 billion. I understand that that's a lot of money, but in the terms of the $7 trillion or whatever it is our budget is screwed up by, it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. I'm sure that we've got to come up with bigger numbers. And I'm not saying we should just leave that out of the equation, but we've got to come up with something more important than that, and basically, it's going to have to be in defense. What else is there? We need to. The only thing I think that needs to be left alone or considered as untouchable are things that are actually going to cost us money down the road. For example, fixing our highways and our sewer systems and our water systems and things like that. Where if you don't do that, it's going to cost you 10 times as much.
No kidding.
Down the road. So there are certain unalienable things that can't be touched and need to be fixed and left money in there. So there is some places that we need to spend money, but there's so many places that we don't need to spend that money that we are spending. Not only that, we're not spending anywhere near that kind of money on repairing all of these things that we should be spending it on it. But we need to consider that, and they need to, the defense, there's so many places there that money is being wasted and thrown away. We keep hearing about all these the tremendous mistakes or losses there, and we need to do something about them. And trying to be policemen or whatever to the world is one of the places that we need to cut back. We need to take care of our own backyard, as they all this old saying goes, and we aren't doing that. We just simply aren't doing that. We're letting our country fall apart trying to take care of somebody else's country. And there is a point, and I understand we need to be citizens of the world because we have no choice at this particular point to do that. But we don't need to go running in head first and diving into being the citizen of the world. We need to let the other countries help us a little. I'm very enheartened by the fact that NATO is taking over, you know, and other countries are helping with this Libyan war. I really thought that was a step in the right direction, even though I do believe that Obama was lying about it in the first place. He just wanted a cover-up to make everybody think that we weren't leading the way. We were leading the way. But at least he got other countries involved, and they're helping out. So I still think we're leading the way, and we're telling them what to do, but at least they're there, and they haven't been before. So if nothing but by default, he has accomplished something there. And I will give him credit for the fact he has mentioned in his budget the Defense Department and cutting the Defense Department. He didn't say by how much I didn't read that part anyway.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, he did mention it, and Ryan didn't.
One thing I wanted to add is the inevitable truth is that America can no longer sustain a welfare warfare state. That is a completely unsustainable model that we've been living in now for a number of years. And as the growth of each one of those plans and as our economy continues to decline, I mean, they're talking about our economy's recovering. Well, it may be recovering in Texas, but it's not recovering in Oregon. And as we talked about last week, you know, the farmers got all excited when they were getting such low prices for their corn, and then we decided to start making fuel out of it, and now the prices are being felt both at the grocery store and at the gas pump.
Right.
And, you know, there's always a law of unintended consequences, that you can do the right thing at the right time for the right reasons and still end up with unintended consequences.
All the time.
And the federal entitlement programs, you're right, if back then the government was far more tolerant of Christian values. Since the 1950s, we have so far moved away from that. And during the Republican administrations, I know there was that effort to allow for compassionate services, to allow some government funding to go to religious organizations to provide some of these frontline services. But just looking here at Cottage Grove, you know, we have a feeding program. We're a community just under 10,000 people. And we have three churches that are providing meals on most nights of the week. And it is not just the street people that are coming in. It is young families. It is senior citizens that simply can't make ends meet.
We've only got a minute left. Just out of curiosity, how many churches are there in Cottage Grove? Do you know? Any idea?
There's about 15.
Oh, so we've got 3 out of 15. Still not real good odds. Sorry.
That's true.
So we are running out of
time. Whoa.
Call it a day. It's amazing.
Happy Easter, everybody.
Yeah. Happy Easter.
Easter's coming up, isn't it? Yeah. So, okay, basically, we really appreciate your sticking with us. Even if you didn't call, next time call. I'm going to pass you. Get your dialing fingers out. My God, that's not that hard. So, we'll be back.
Until next time.
Have a good day.
If you like today's show, please let us know by visiting us on Facebook and clicking on the like button. You can also get show updates on Twitter and on our website at www.krbnradio.com. This is KRBN Internet News Talk Radio.